Welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. I know it feels like summer is ending, right? Vacations are over, students are back in school. But there's still plenty of time to enjoy the outdoors, including the excellent municipal parks and greenways. If you haven't been yet, you might want to check out the John Craddock Wetland Nature Preserve in Muncie on the city's east side. John Craddock is the Director Emeritus of the city's Bureau of Water Quality. In fact, he started the city's Water Pollution Control Agency in 1972 after working on pollution issues while at Ball State. Today, the discussion about White River pollution usually concerns combined sewer overflows. But John Craddock remembers what the river was like at its worst in the late 1960s and early 70s.
And this is when it was red and green, orange, blue, every color, the rainbow that one could think of, except you don't want it that color. This was also the same period of time that across the United States, it wasn't just Muncie, Indiana, it wasn't just the White River. This is during the same period of time that, like, the Cuyahoga River in Ohio was burning and catching fire. Don't forget that EPA came into existence in 1970. The reason that it came into existence was because we as a society had not done environmentally what we should be doing. So our White River was pretty typical as the rivers across the United States. It was highly polluted. It was full of industrial waste, raw sewage. It was weedy. It was overgrown. It smelled. There were tires, refrigerators, bicycles. We drove over it and went to work as a society. We ignored it. We turned our backs on it. And it was not used recreationally for hardly anything. And that was pretty much the way a lot of our streams were.
How did they get that way?
I personally believe a lot of it was ignorance. The word environment wasn't even in our vocabulary until around 1970. The research and the equipment, the laboratory equipment, the scientific studies available to know the effects of chrome and cadmium and a lot of the items on what we call the TTO list, total toxic organic list, which is 100 different items such as pesticides and PCBs and those type of things. Some of them we couldn't even hardly test for and detect, let alone have any long-term studies knowing about anything from birth defects to potential cancer-producing agents. These were studies that came along later. So a lot of the disposal methods that were taking place in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s in particular, I believe were done out of ignorance. That doesn't make it right, but for the most part, my feeling is that that was pretty much it. We didn't realize that if we dumped this on the ground behind our particular facility, that it could end up in our groundwater system and our aquifers and therefore contaminate our stream and therefore contaminate maybe local wells.
How did you get involved?
I was a senior at Ball State University. I was a natural resource student. We had a chance to do either during a winter time to do a field project or a term paper. I had gotten out of a four-year hitch in the service and was going to school on the GI Bill. It takes a while to catch back up those skills after a break from high school. I wasn't overly hot on doing a paper, so I decided to do a field project. And my field project was setting up 13 base stations on the White River and using a lab at Ball State in the Natural Resource Department to do testing to find out the condition of our White River. Within a short period of time, we found out through lab results that it was highly polluted and that we had a lot of problems. That we also was the year that we had our first Earth Day at Ball State. It's also the year that EPA came into existence. So the stars were aligning, if you will. The public was becoming knowledgeable. TV programs were happening. Newspapers were doing articles. So I gave a talk at the first Earth Day at Ball State. Our local Ball State University newspaper picked up on that and did a couple articles. We had two newspapers at that time in Muncie. the Morning Star and the Evening Press. Both those newspapers picked up from Ball State's newspaper and wanted to know what was going on. And there were some early newspaper reporters like Floyd Creech and some of those individuals back then. Dick Green, who used to do an Our Neighborhood series weekly in the paper. And they picked up on this and wanted to know what was being done. And of course, as with many communities across the United States, really not much. So the public support started building because they kept doing more articles as I kept finding more problems. The class got over with. I did turn in a research grant to continue it at Ball State, and it was turned down. So I financed it out of my own pocket for the next 6 months while I was still a student, and kept finding more and more and more. And the newspapers stayed with us and kept producing more articles and more articles. And so several times a week there would be articles in the paper. And the public support built. That turned into then all of a sudden your Rotary, your Kiwanis, your Lions, your JCs, a variety of your service organizations wanted to know what was going on. So now you're into a speaking engagement. So you're educating the public. So now the public is becoming fairly well educated on what's going on, and the questions start being asked, why is not something being done? That then turned into a part-time job for about 3 or 4 months. The part-time job then turned into a full-time job. I wrote a 32-page proposal to create the Bureau, and that full-time job turned into the Bureau of Water Quality that came into existence March of 1972. Of which then I retired 31 years later.
John Craddock, who started Muncie's Water Pollution Control Agency, now known as the Bureau of Water Quality. He points out that many river cities had horrendous pollution problems in the 1960s and before. Remember the Cuyahoga River actually catching on fire? We've come a long way since then, but there's still plenty of work to do, especially with CSOs.
Oh, Blackwater, keep on rolling.
Mississippi moon, won't you keep on shining on me?
Indiana Weekend, Real Radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com.
What was the reaction that you got as these newspaper, these news accounts continued and you're out speaking in the community? Was everybody on board? Were there people who told you, look, this is industry, these are jobs?
No, that did not happen. But it did not happen for a specific reason. It happened in many towns across the United States. It did not happen in Muncie because we decided that we were going to attack it from a different attitude. The Bureau, as it was set up, was a regulatory enforcement agency, same as EPA, but on the local level. We could levy a $1,000 a day fine, administrative fine, from my desk for each parameter that was out of limits. So if an industry in town was over for chrome, copper, and zinc, that's a $3,000 a day fine or a $90,000 a month fine. Our philosophy was to go in the door, work with the industry, have the equipment put in that's called pretreatment equipment to treat that toxic waste on site, put the money into the physical pieces of equipment that could run any place from $30,000 to $800,000, depending on the size of the industry, the volume, whether we're talking about cyanide or oil, is it an oil separation unit, is it a cyanide destruct unit, is it a settling chamber for heavy metals to drop out, depending on what the problem was and what the solution was. But we would set up a enforcement compliance schedule that both our organization as the enforcement agency and the industry would sign. But we would sit down as a team to work out over what period of time is it going to take to engineer this, to order the equipment, to get it in, to get it up and running, and then a 30-day period to get all the kinks worked out of it, if you will, to make sure that that equipment's working properly. So we might, for a large project, such as an $800,000 project, we might have a 12-month compliance schedule with deadlines that have to be met. And the fines kick in if you don't meet the deadline. The money sitting in the bank does not clean up the problem. if you're in the middle of a court case, the discharge is still going while the court case is going. So we took a little different attitude. We want the clean water without loss of jobs. The other thing that we did was we set up a Muncie Industrial Clean Water and Waste Management Council. It was made up of each industry in town, plus our organization. Once a month, we met at a conference room in each industry around town, and we went over the new laws that were coming out, how they would affect you. We thought that the industry generally were speaking with each other. We found out that there was not much communication. Within a short period of time of those monthly meetings, all of a sudden, we found out that the telephone communication was taking place across town. We understand you've corrected your problem this way. Is that true? We've got the same problem. Which firm did you use? Were you pleased with the work that they did for you when you hired them? And all of a sudden, the lines of communication was opening between the industry and then between the Bureau as an enforcement agency and the industry that we were enforcing. In 31 years, I only had to issue one $1,000 fine. So it did work. Yet the industrial community invested over $20 million for pretreatment. This is not yearly operational costs. This is not staff time. This is hardcore equipment. $20 million across town in various industrial complexes. And that allowed them to stay into business. And as a matter of fact, when the plating rigs came in, we had 10 plating firms, and they already had their equipment installed. And 40% of the plating firms closed across the United States. Ours, the business actually increased because that business had to go someplace because they had the proper equipment installed and they were meeting discharges and our river was being cleaned up. And then as a last resort, you still had the laws, you still had the fines.
These results of the pollution had been happening for years and yes. It didn't bother people. Now you're telling these people, we have to change this. We've got to do better and it's going to cost you some money.
Yes.
How did those conversations go? Was there a point at which they saw the light? Was there pushback? Did they try to get you fired? Anything like that?
Well, not that I'm aware of. Now, I don't know about behind the scenes, but I don't think so. We tried to do it very professionally. And that's why we went about it the way we went it. Rather than many other towns, if there was a violation, they just issued a fine. So then on the next violation, another fine. Next violation, another fine. So what are you accomplishing? Then they start realizing that if they wrote their ordinances allowing them to do some of this, like we were doing, that they could accomplish the same thing. So we found that our local ordinance was being used as a model then, and people were rewriting their ordinances more along the lines of what Muncie had their ordinance written as. A lot of the ordinances had been written by consulting firms. We wrote our own ordinance, so there was a difference too. We set it up the way we felt it would work best as long as it met state and federal law, which it did. It ended up being used by EPA as a model for teaching too, because it worked well. The pushback that you asked about and the breakthrough probably took place about 6 months after the Clean Water Council was established. Everybody in the room could see that everybody was being treated the same. That was terribly important so that there was not a miscommunication that I'm on this side of town and how come XYZ person on the other side of town is not having to do what I'm having to do. Everybody's in the same room and they're all talking to each other and they're all realizing that everybody's having to do the same thing. We're all in the same boat. I started to get tired of repeating myself all the time, every time you had to go to an industry to work on a problem. And that's how the Clean Water Council came about. Let's just be able to say it once to the group, and then if there's questions, we can answer them, and everybody hears the same answer in the same tone and everything.
John Craddock, one of the state's best-known advocates for White River. In 1972, he started the agency that became Muncie's Bureau of Water Quality. Amazing the progress that's been made since then. When we come back, encountering the river on bicycles and hiking trails.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
You go down to the river a lot now, you take photographs. Tell us about what you see, what you think about after 30 years of this fight.
Nature photography has been my hobby since the early 70s, along the time of starting the Bureau. And because of that, I took pictures, so that's why we have pictures of when it was red and green and orange and yellow and a variety of colors. It was devoid of a lot of wildlife besides just in the river. I mean, the bird life along the river, just a lot of. I remember the first time that the beaver colonies moved back into town. I remember the first time we saw our first mink. I remember the first time we saw our first muskrat. The first time we saw our first osprey, the bald eagle. The first time we saw a blue heron. Those didn't happen until the late 80s. I mean, clear up until the late 80s, we did not have blue herons in Muncie. You did not have osprey in Muncie. Each one of those came back slowly as the ecology of that stream changed and the habitat. We also were careful with the habitat. We left the south bank go wild, and most of the south bank is wooded and forested. And that is for your wildlife. And then the north bank generally through town is where we have our White River Greenway paved path. And before that, it was just a mowed area for jogging and fishing. But now we have an actual path through there. And so the north side is for human use, and the south side is for our wildlife population to disappear into if they need a place to go. If we develop both sides of the river all the way through town, then we will move all of the wildlife out of town, and you will have to go back upstream or downstream to find that wildlife like you did 40 years ago. So it was done that way on purpose, so that we could have the best of both worlds.
Does the presence of the bicycle, the exercise path, the greenway, that's important in helping people connect with the river, right?
It's even more important than that. It's very important even economically. When a new business, a new industry thinks about moving to a town, they usually have pre-meetings that are extremely private with the, usually it's your mayor, your chamber of commerce, and your utilities in town. I remember back in the 70s and the 80s when the primary discussion at that period of time, I was one of those individuals that would meet, we would meet with, and that was when a industry or a commercial establishment may have six towns they were looking at, you were one of the six towns. Nothing was in the newspaper yet, this was just private discussions, they're looking. So at that period of time, they were wanting to know about labor workforce, about tax and incentives, those type of things were on the top two, three of the most important of what they were looking for. That changed over a period of time to where by the time I retired, the top two or three that they would ask, the others were on the list, but they had moved down the list. They wanted to know about the recreational facilities for their staff people in the community, the educational facilities for the community, the recreational facilities for their staff. The quality of life, if you will, of the community took precedent over the others. So the list of 10 kind of went upside down. And this started to take place during the 90s, late 90s, and now it's very prevalent. So communities now, it's the quality of life. And that's why people are looking heavily at their trail systems, their park systems, their educational institutions, their recreational facilities, their eating establishments. Quality of life, rather than just living, is extremely important now.
When did you start to see results? And tell me a story about being down by the river or in some moment when you began to see this is working, this is really making a difference.
Our river was so heavily polluted that actually the first several years we were a little disappointed. We were out there doing biological studies. We were doing studies on fish and fish species, number of fish species, types of fish, aquatic insects, freshwater mussels. And those first three, four, five, 6 years, we weren't seeing much of a change. And yet, we knew that we were eliminating chrome discharges and oil discharges and cyanide discharges, and it just kept going. We realized that it was so heavily polluted that it was like peeling back layers of an onion, if you will. And we had to get so many layers peeled back before we would actually see the change. And I remember one year, all of a sudden, and it must have been late 70s in there somewhere, to where all of a sudden we started to see the increase in aquatic insects. We found our first freshwater mussels that weren't there when we came and hadn't been there maybe for 20, 30, 40 years. We started to see a change in the aquatic insects to where we would only find tubiflex worms and those organisms that are found in highly polluted water. We started to find stoneflies, mayflies, caddisflies that are clean water species. To where now you're up to the point to where we went from 30 species of fish to up to 65 species of fish now, more than doubled them. The aquatic insects, we were down, like I said, to the tubiflex worms, and once in a while you'd run into something else, to now over 150 species, of which I think approximately at least 70% are clean water species. The freshwater mussels did not exist within the city limits of Muncie. Too polluted. The bottom 2 feet of the river, when we started, was sewage, sludge, and industrial muck. When you stepped in it with your waders, there was a black ooze would come out. Now it's sand, gravel, or bedrock.
That night we went down to the river. Then into the river we died. Oh,
John Craddock, Director Emeritus of Muncie's Bureau of Water Quality, who actually started the agency in 1972 after working on pollution issues while a student at Ball State. Back then, heavy metals, oil, and other pollutants could turn the river a bright green, orange, or other colors. This was common across the country. In Cleveland, the Cuyahoga River fire near a steel mill in 1969 helped spur the environmental movement. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency was founded the next year. Today, the discussion about White River pollution usually concerns combined sewer overflows. And while we've come a long way, there's still plenty more to do. And that, River fans, is our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Doman's Furniture of Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from FlexSteel, Bassett, and Simmons Beautyrest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.